This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back to Midday Mobile, and it's time for a checkup. Joining us from AltPoint, Dr. William Tillman, who's a psychiatrist and in to talk about medication-assisted treatment. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so for those who are not familiar with this, like me, medication-assisted treatment, what is it and how does it help people that are suffering and dealing with opioid abuse?
All right, so medication-assisted treatment is essentially using special medications that also affect the opioid receptors, but in a different way than the drugs of abuse that we typically think about, like heroin, fentanyl, or pills off the streets. And so we utilize these medications in order to reduce cravings, to facilitate further recovery, while preventing a lot of the negative effects we typically associate with drug use or other medications that would affect those receptors.
Now, okay, so give me some parlance I can understand.
Gotcha.
A simple version here. Like, does it block the desire for it? Does it replace it? Does it,
So a large part of it is reducing the cravings, and it is obviously very complicated, but we're going to simplify it down.
That's what I need.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I've been working on some analogies for the last couple of days.
Okay.
So the thing about receptors is that I think of them like a door. There's a couple of different aspects about receptors. One is how wide the door opens, right? And then one, think about like how hard the door is to open or how forcefully you can push it open. So certain drugs may open the door very quickly or with a lot of force, but only a part of the way. It doesn't open the door all the way. And that's kind of the essence of medication-assisted treatment is these medications, especially buprenorphine, it binds very strongly to the receptor. It can even kick off, other opioids, but it doesn't stimulate it as strongly.
Okay.
So it's basically able to maintain some activity on those receptors, so it keeps the door open a little bit.
Right.
But not to the extent to where it would cause things like euphoria that we associate with addiction.
But it takes away some of the
cravings.
Bad, the cravings.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And that's the main aspect of it, is taking away the cravings. And a big part also of medication strategies, and this applies to general psychiatry as well, is trying to move things to longer acting medications. The longer the medication acts for, the less frequently you have to take it. The more you can decouple the physiological effects of it from the psychological aspect. So for instance, kind of the other end of it would be, okay, I feel bad now. What do I do? I'm going to take something for how I feel now. Mm-hmm. And that reinforces the cycle of I feel away, I take something. I feel away, I take something. But with longer acting medications, you should not necessarily be, depending on the medicine, you shouldn't necessarily be noticing it kicking in or kicking out, right?
Okay.
So especially something like antidepressants, right? Like
right.
Zoloft. I tell my patients, you shouldn't be able to really tell when you took your Zoloft in the day. It's up and running after you've been on it for weeks or months, and it's kind of running at a consistent level. It doesn't really wear off in the middle of the day. And that sort of helps remove that impulse to do something else to feel a different way in terms of taking something.
That's really interesting because, think about it. You're doing two things. There's the chemical reaction, but there's also habit.
Yes.
Right? Just physical habit.
A huge aspect of it is the habit. And also, these habits start getting ingrained with other habits and things of our lives. One of the things that people who try to stop smoking have difficulties with is the idea of a smoke break.
100%. Right.
And so trying to replace that can be difficult. And for some of my patients, I work them through, all right, so we're going to do some breathing techniques kind of with the mouth a little bit open to kind of restrict the breathing to kind of recreate that feeling of dragging on a cigarette, right? And so we try to find ways to replace if we can. And when there's not as much of a chemical aspect driving it, it's not going to stay as strongly reinforced over time.
This is great having a psychiatrist in who's dealing in our brains and dealing with chemicals, but if y'all couldn't see him, but he just did physical manifestations of behaviors too. So that's obviously part of it. It didn't.
Oh yeah, it's all of it. I try to be as, I guess, I don't like the word holistic because I feel like people use it too much.
Right.
Now. Maybe like.
But I follow what you're saying. Yeah. I'm with you too. That word sometimes people are like, ooh.
Yeah, it's like, exactly. But, it's got a woo-woo feel to it sometimes. It's like, oh, quantum.
but no, it's like people are addicted to things. There's the smoking thing really hit with me watching this. There's a physical behavior and pattern people have with this. Mm-hmm. Even though there's a chemical part of it, their hands do something. Their mouth does something.
Exactly. And that's, you know, when people quit smoking, they may start snacking more. They'll chew gum.
Yes.
That's when I recommend people replace it with gum, sunflower seeds, that kind of thing, just to fulfill that that oral fixation aspect. You know, our brains are very, very, very complicated. We still don't understand them all the way. And one of the things that that we're gaining an appreciation for as a field is the aspect of the brain always trying to predict what's about to happen next. So that's how things become sort of patterns. And so you can see this in different like optical illusions or phenomenon. Like if you've ever had like a blind spot test where you have like the two X's on the index card, close one eye, and you move it closer and one of those X's go away and you're like, oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
Your brain is always having to fill in that information in that gap. And it does that, you know, I tell my patients that your brain is a squishy computer.
Right.
And so,
good.
Computers largely, like in terms of populating what's going to be next on your screen, frame to frame, a lot of it works on principles of data compression, which is don't send the whole packet of every single pixel what it needs to be. You can send change data, and it does that based on predictions. And it's like, all right, I only need to update half the data. That's more energy efficient. Our brains do a lot of that as well. So our brains are predicting what's about to happen all the time in the background. And then it takes the sensory information and it reconciles those two to sort of create your reality. And that's how, you know, a lot of psychological phenomenon can be seen through that lens. I think it's a very helpful explanatory paradigm in terms of explaining things like, why do people tend to do the same things over and over again? Mm-hmm. Or how does anticipatory fear work? How does the brain start to see shadow figures out of the corner of the eye with PTSD,
right?
These are a lot of mechanisms that are just how
the predictive
brain. Exactly. Okay. And there's a lot of information on the internet about predictive processing theory as it relates to psychiatry, but it's kind of gradually getting more and more integrated into clinical practice. I mean, it's focused for me especially.
Well, then you have to come back and talk more about that because that's fascinating
to me. I'd love to.
So with medical-assisted treatment, what are you doing? Like, what is it like when they start on, somebody comes in, they're addicted, you do this, you open the door a little bit, like you said, but not wide open. Is it on a rheostat? Do they start a little bit and then go more, or is it?
It depends somewhat on what agent you're using or what medication you're using. Methadone, the dose does have to be worked up a little more gradually. In my experience, Suboxone, which is a combination of the buprenorphine and naloxone, that has become more seen as more favorable for one reason, because it's much more safer in terms of misuse and the lower abuse potential.
Okay.
So one of the cool aspects about Suboxone is that that second aspect of it is essentially will block opioid receptors, but it doesn't do much. It's not really absorbed when you take it sublingually, so like under the tongue.
Mm-hmm.
So these medicines, if you take it the way you're supposed to, it doesn't really block those receptors. But let's say if someone was like, I see what I'm going to do. I'm going to take this pill you gave me, and I'm going to melt it down and inject it. Well, that's when it kicks in, and it blocks things. So it has a much lower abuse potential. So it has a lot more flexibility in terms of the prescribing habits, like from
it seems to have some guardrails on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's got built-in chemical guardrails, so that gives us a lot more flexibility in terms of how often someone has to come in. So like for methadone, typically it's daily.
Okay.
And that can be very cumbersome for people, but Suboxone, I can prescribe that monthly and do monthly visits. And so, you know,
it's a lot better for people's lifestyle.
It is, especially. Because that can be incredibly burdensome. Have to show up at a clinic at, you know, 7 o'clock every single morning, or you feel terrible.
Right.
You know, it is definitely better than nothing. And there are definitely cases where the methadone is more effective for certain patients. So I don't want to down methadone, but in general, for my purposes, Suboxone is a lot more useful. And I can get people, basically up to their maintenance dose within a day or two.
Wow. So you see this with your patients, people that were, you know, that are hooked on opioids, been fighting this forever, mm-hmm. and then it's not years, it may just be weeks or months before they have some freedom from that addiction.
Yeah. I have worked at our crisis center in the past, and occasionally I cover it when my boss is out of town, and do a lot more direct substance treatment there than my own clinic. I'm trying to build up my patient panel. But for those patients that are coming in, unless they're on, I've been taking fentanyl, that's a little more complicated. But for other opioids, I can run it as kind of like an urgent care. Like, give me, you know, 3-4 hours, I can get you detoxed onto your maintenance dose and out the door, ready to follow up with someone in clinic.
Fantastic. If people are listening to us right now, want to, you know, reach out for themselves or loved mm-hmm. one, how do they make this happen for medically assisted treatment? Right.
So for me and my clinic, it would be, you know, calling the Accordia Family Medicine Clinic is where, you know, my office is situated within. I'm in an integrated model within the family medicine clinic there, so which I love. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of good collaborative care with my patient's primary care physician, especially for a lot of my patients. You know, it's not just people who decided one day to start abusing opioids.
Sure. And this is the story with so many people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's they have either a chronic pain condition, or they had some bad chronic pain in the past, got hooked on prescriptions and had trouble getting off. And so, you know, for these patients, it really can be a game changer, giving them back their, you know, their freedom.
Absolutely. That means so much to so many people. Dr. William Tillman, thank you for coming in. Thanks for being part of the show.
Of course.